Welcome to the You Love and You Learn podcast, the place to learn about all things love, relationships, relationship anxiety, and to deconstruct the one-size-fits-all narrative of what it means to be in a happy relationship. I'm your host, Sarah Yudkin, a relationship anxiety coach who's on a mission to discuss the nuances of love and relationships that I wish someone would have shared with me years ago. My goal with each episode is for you to leave with an expanded definition of love and relationships and with practices to carry with you in your life and relationships on a day-to-day basis. I'm so grateful to have you here. Welcome back, everybody. I'm so excited to bring you this episode. I got to sit down with someone who I've looked up to for a long time now, and that is Dr. Kristen Neff, who is a pioneer in self-compassion research and who conducted the first empirical studies on self-compassion over 20 years ago. She has been recognized as one of the most influential researchers in psychology worldwide, and Kristen has written several best-selling books on self-compassion and co-founded the Center for Mindful Self-Compassion. And I have a feeling you are going to love this conversation, especially if you're anything like me and your inner critic tends to be really big and strong. Dr. Neff talks about how that is something that is actually hardwired into us, but self-compassion can be something we really practice and cultivate more of in our relationships to ourselves so that we can have that same relationship of compassion with other people. So really excited for you to hear this one, and let's get into it. Hi, Kristen. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, Sarah. It's great to be here.
Yeah, your work has been so impactful for me. And I think I've shared your TED Talk now with probably 100 people because everyone needs to see the information that you're talking about with self-compassion. So I'm really excited to explore the key pieces of it today and how it can affect our relationships.
Great. I love the idea of how self-compassion connects to our relationship with others as well as ourselves.
Yeah. And it was funny. I actually took the self-compassion quiz on your website today, which I'll have to make sure to link in the show notes for anybody. But I got a score of like an average of around 3. And I think it's out of 5, right? So I remembered at one point taking that and it being a little bit lower, but now it's still lower than I'd like it to be. So I had to practice my own moment of self-compassion today when I realized I still have some practicing to do.
Yeah, well, so you don't want to beat yourself up for beating yourself up. So that's good. You're self-compassionate about your average self-compassion score, which is very average, around 3 most people get.
That's interesting to hear. Yeah. So has self-compassion always come naturally to you, or has it been something that you've actively had to practice?
So I would say that I'm not a particularly bad self-critic. I first learned about self-compassion back in graduate school. So I learned it first as a personal practice while I was learning mindfulness meditation. And the way I found it really, really useful was supporting myself. I was going through a very stressful period in my life and actually had just gotten divorced. And my relationship life was a bit of a mess. And I was also stressed about school. And so I had never, to be quite honest, considered the idea that you could intentionally turn inward and treat yourself like a good friend and be kind and warm and supportive and give yourself, have your own back, give yourself reassurances, for instance. And that's really what was so transformative for me. It is a practice, though. And I think there are actually some evolutionary reasons why self or compassion comes more naturally for others than ourselves. So everyone has to do it a little bit intentionally. It's a mindset. It's not like a trait that you have forever. It's you get in the state and then you get out of the state, in and out.
Would you mind sharing those evolutionary reasons why you found that we're more likely to give compassion to others? Because I know that for someone like myself, who it definitely is a practice for me, or it feels like it might be challenging at times, it's cool to hear that sometimes there's a reason for why that might be.
Yeah, yes. So by evolution, and of course, you know this, when we're threatened in some way, we go into fight, flight, or freeze mode. It's a simplified version, but it's a useful model. So when we're personally threatened by a mistake we've made or a failure or something really challenging, we feel this sense of threat. So we turn the fight, flight, or freeze response inward, largely to want to control our situation so we can be safe. So we fight ourselves, we beat ourselves up, partly try to keep ourselves safe. We think we'll get ourselves in line so we'll be safe, or maybe we'll, if we beat ourselves up, it won't be so painful when other people judge us. That's another way to be safe. Or we flee into a sense of shame and isolation. That's also an evolutionary safety behavior. When you flee from the group, you actually are more safe. So mentally we flee into shame, or we freeze and we get stuck. And we kind of think, if I think about this again and again and again, maybe the problem will go away, or I'll figure it out, right? So these are natural safety behaviors. We don't do it. Ironically, we do it because we care about ourselves, because we're trying to be safe. Now, when your best friend or someone you really care about, when they make a mistake or fail, you aren't so personally threatened. Mm-hmm. Now, by the way, sometimes when people are really close, like our significant other, sometimes we're more reactive to them. When we start merging our sense of self with others, then we're more likely to go into fight, flight, or freeze with them as well. But normally it's easier to do this with others. What happens is we tap into the care response, or sometimes it's called the tend and befriend response. This is also a natural evolutionary behavior, but it was passed down genetically more to care toward others, toward our offspring or our fellow group members or in-group members. So when we care for our offspring or, you know, family or group members when they're suffering, then our genes are also more likely to pass down to future generations. So it feels more natural to be caring toward others and to be self-critical or really hard with ourselves. The good news is even though it's feels a little bit more natural, we can easily tap in. We can do this hack of tapping into the care system for ourselves. We have to do it with a little bit of an intention. So we might say something like, how would I treat a really good friend I cared about who was going through the exact same situation I'm going through? Then we often know what to say, how to be supportive. Or what would someone who really cared about me say right now to me? So, you know, that's partly why it's more difficult for ourselves.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. It makes a lot of sense. And that first thing you just mentioned about how you would treat a friend or how you would want a friend to speak to you, is that how you would describe the first pillar of self-compassion that you talk about, the self-kindness piece?
Yeah, so there are three pillars and I can go through all of them, but the kind of the most obvious pillar is kindness. And I think thinking of the context of close friendship is probably the best way to think about it, because in many ways, close friendships are defined by mutually supportive interactions. Sometimes our family members, we aren't always so supportive, right? Or people who aren't really good friends, it may be because we aren't so supportive. But what makes a good friendship, a close friendship, is we're there for each other. So there's the experience of both giving and receiving compassion, care, and support in times of difficulty. So most of us, obviously some people are isolated and don't have a lot of friends, but many people have the experience of a close friendship, or even maybe caring for their pet or someone else that they love. So the template's there. We just need to draw on that template and treat ourselves with the same kindness and care that comes more naturally to show to others.
I found that to be one of the most helpful or most intuitive pillars of the three. And I found that sometimes when I have the inner critic that comes up, that part is hard to kind of control. And so what matters more is the response that I give when that inner critic comes up and how I would show up for a friend. So is that how you think of it too? Like, we're not trying to get rid of the critic?
Well, exactly. Because we have to remember the inner critic is trying to keep us safe. That's what its role is in our system, is trying to keep us safe. And so often the intention of the inner critic is a good one, but the means it has for achieving its goal of keeping us safe are often counterproductive, right? It's just like an instinctual behavior. And in fact, what we know very clearly through the research is that kindness and support is more effective at keeping us safe than harsh self-criticism. But this is kind of the reptilian brain. That's all it knows how to do, is attack, right? That part of ourselves. So we can actually have compassion for our inner critic. We can say things like, thank you so much for trying to keep me safe. I hear you. I will take into consideration maybe the dangers you pointed out for me, but maybe there's another way I want to deal with this situation, so that we aren't blended with the inner critic, so that we've got other voices, like the voice of our compassionate self, which more often comes out to others. We can also listen to that way of responding.
So,
the whole system really, you might say, its intention is good. It's about safety, driving for happiness, and it's just finding the way that works the best, the most effectively, which actually is compassion and support.
Yeah.
Very similar to parenting. If you think of like what a good parent does, you unconditionally love your child. You also have boundaries. You've got expectations because it's not loving to say, do whatever you want, you know? And again, it comes a little more naturally when we think about caring for others. And we need to use that same approach with ourselves to be healthy, really.
So well said. It's almost neutralizing a little bit. Like the critic still gets to have its place and it's, yeah. We know its role, but then we also give more energy to that kind self that we all have. And we know how to give to like the closest people in our life.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Beautiful. So that second pillar, do you want to go through what that looks like and how we practice it?
Yeah. So another key pillar of self-compassion is mindfulness. And actually, temporally, before we give ourselves kindness, we need to be mindful. So most people have heard about mindfulness at this point, but basically it's a way of turning toward and being with whatever's arising in the present moment without going. So when what's happening is painful, like a painful thought about ourselves or just a really painful situation, our instinct, again, this is a safety behavior, is to do one of two things. Either we ignore it, we pretend it's not there, we put our head in the sand and, you know, if I don't think about it, it's not there. Or we try to fight it and resist it. And when we do that, we get sucked into problem solving and how we get lost in the negative thoughts and emotions. So in order to treat ourselves like we would treat a good friend, we need some perspective, right? So if we're lost in the negative thoughts and emotions, we can't like step outside of ourselves to say, hey, what do you need right now? It would be most healthy and helpful. And at the same time, if we ignore it, if we just stiff up our lip and pretend this is not a problem, we can't help ourselves either. So mindfulness is kind of the sense of awareness that, hey, this is a problem, or I'm suffering in some way, I hurt. So giving some space to that so we aren't ignoring it, but we aren't also lost in it. And then we respond with kindness. How can I help myself in the moment? What's the most supportive, encouraging, or helpful thing I can do right now? And by the way, that doesn't necessarily mean letting yourself off the hook or letting things slide. That's not helpful. What's the most healthy and helpful way I can relate to myself in this moment? Those are the two pillars. And then the third pillar is actually really key. And this is the one that is often very tricky to people. They don't really know how to interpret it, but I call it common humanity, or another way of thinking of it is connection to the larger whole. So our brains are also designed to think of ourselves as separate from the universe, separate from other people, as these isolated, separate individuals, when the reality is actually much more complex. The way our brains work, we're constantly interacting with the emotions and thoughts of others. The way the environment works, we're part of this larger whole. We know this from science, but we are part of a larger ecosystem. And a lot of that sense of that I am isolated and separate and disconnected from the rest of the world is actually an illusion created by the brain. And so what happens because of this, let's say you make a mistake, it feels like everyone else in the world is living a normal mistake-free life, and it's just me who's messed up, or it's just me who's going through this breakup, or it's just me who's facing this challenging situation. It's actually not a logical response, because we know logically that's not true, but it's an emotional response, because again, our brains, and I won't go into it, but they're designed to create this sense of separate self. So what self-compassion does is that actually we actually frame our experience in light of the shared experience, right? So to be human means to make mistakes. It means to be imperfect. When we say we're only human, it means we, you know, face challenges in life. To be human does not mean to be perfect. And so when we remember our shared humanity, instead of being like self-pity, poor me, woe is me, we're expanding our sense of self. So we have kind of a larger, more interconnected sense of self. We remember, okay, this is how we learn. You know, if I make a mistake, I don't have to take it so personally. It doesn't mean I'm a horrible person. I'm human. Okay. So what can I learn from this? How can I grow from that? And that's also what makes self-compassion healthy, by reminding us of our essential interconnectedness.
Yeah. I love that one. I'd love to go into both of those in a little bit more depth, but especially with the common humanity, I'm curious what your thoughts are on this with social media. I feel like it can help and hurt common humanity because it connects you. Like for example, in my online community, people are like, wow, like other people feel the same way. And there's this common humanity right away that you reach. But then on the flip side of that, when you're comparing yourself to other people, yeah. It's easy to get stuck in that sense of, oh, everyone else has their life figured out. Everyone else has a happier relationship than I do. So what do you think? Is it like a net positive or is it net negative?
I think you're right. It's both. You know, I think it can be used for either. I think intentional communities. Like I also have a self-compassion community, intentional communities where the ethos is to share, including sharing our struggles and imperfections. I think that can be really helpful. If it's not intentional, it's just taking like this filtered selfie of myself. Look at my wonderful vacation that you aren't having. Mm-hmm. Then it can create more disconnection. And also what we're referring to is also related to another dichotomy I like to make between self-esteem and self-compassion. So self-esteem is a judgment or an evaluation of worth, like esteem. You know, do I esteem myself positively or negatively? Compassion is how are we with the difficulties of life? The sense of worth that comes with compassion is unconditional. Like when a baby is born, it doesn't have to go to graduate school to be worthy of compassion, right? So all human beings, it's kind of intrinsic to our humanity, our flawed humanity, that compassion is part of the human experience. So the thing about social comparison, and there's actually research on this, we compare ourselves to others to get self-esteem. And by the way, it's not okay to be average. We need to be above average, just as baseline, to have self-esteem, which means we're always on the losing side of that comparison, or at least often so. Whereas with compassion, there's no social comparison needed because it is intrinsic to our humanity. So the sense of self-worth that comes from compassion is not comparative and it's much more stable over time. And so the reason that's important is in social media, from a place of compassion, instead of saying, how does that person stack up compared to me? Am I better? Am I worse? Which is feeding the self-esteem treadmill, which you can never get off of. You can use actually social media, especially in intentional communities, to really bolster that sense of connection that we're all doing the best we can. We have a lot of shared experiences. You know, the intention of the person consuming the social media, in addition to the intention of the people creating the content for social media, I think makes a big difference in how its effect.
Absolutely. Yeah, those are both really good points. I'm glad that you brought in that piece on self-esteem, because that was something that I learned from you as well, which is instead of kind of who's better, who's worse, compassion is a little bit more across all people. Like we all have our flaws. We all are imperfect.
Yeah. And we also all have our strengths, right?
Exactly.
So we appreciate our humanity of the strengths and the weaknesses, the foibles, the triumphs, all of it. And yeah. Sometimes we like to say the goal of self-compassion is simply to be a compassionate mess. Mm. It's not that our goal is to be a mess. Of course it's not. But when the mess occurs, which it will, because we're human, our goal is to be compassionate toward that mess. And when you start, so your aim starts to be different. With self-esteem, you're always trying to improve the mess, self-improvement. How can I better myself? And with self-compassion, again, we want to be happy and healthy. So we want to correct behaviors that are causing harm. Of course we do. But our goal is more, is my heart open or not? You know, am I feeling connected to others? Am I feeling warmth and kindness? That's actually what's most important to me. And so your aim is slightly different and the way you approach things is slightly different. For instance, I'm sure you know this, a learning and growth orientation as opposed to performance orientation, which mm-hmm. means it's not about how well I perform for my self-worth. It's, am I learning? Am I growing? I mean, you know, is this healthy? That's what becomes more important to you.
Definitely. One of my goals for this year, I decided to try ceramics, and it's more challenging than I thought it would be because I've been seeing all these clips on social media of the finished product and or making people that are experts making the pottery, and it seems so natural. So it's definitely a skill and a practice. And yeah. One of my goals heading into the class was I don't have to make perfect pieces. I just want to try and have fun. And even that mindset is actually something I'm still practicing every class because it is a new skill. So it's always a reminder to focus on the process, not the result, but easier said than done sometimes.
Yeah, well, I think we do have to remind ourselves again, because these are natural brain functions. I mean, some people think, okay, I'm not good at self-compassion or I'm not good at mindfulness. Well, there's a reason why. Evolutionary reasons, the way our brains are designed. This is, again, part of the mess. We have messy brains. We have tricky brains. They do this to us. And so we need to be kind to ourselves for these tendencies to compare, to be perfectionists. Of course we are. We all want to be loved. We all want to feel worthy. It's so natural. It's so human. And even the moment you say that, then you kind of shifted from, again, as you say, the content, what am I producing or what's the outcome, to the process. Am I relating to this with warmth, with kindness, with, you know, love, if you can use that word, in my heart? And that's really what starts to feed you after a while. Like with me, I'm a little less interested in what I produce and a lot more interested in how I'm relating to myself and every moment of experience. Again, is my heart open or not? That's what I want. I want my heart to be open and I want to feel connected. It's nice to be successful too, but it's not the be all and end all.
Definitely. Yeah. Something that I believe as well. And I have to guide myself sometimes lovingly back to that place if I notice it's going off course. So,
and ironically, what we know from the research is the more our hearts are open and we have this learning orientation, actually, it does increase our performance. Like we taught self-compassion to NCAA athletes to be compassionate toward their mistakes and like their training routines or games. And their performance did improve because, you know, you don't have all that anxiety. Is this good enough? Or what does this say about me? It kind of clears all that up. And then you can focus a lot more effectively on, okay, how do I learn from this? How can I, you know, learn from this mistake, move forward?
Yeah,
you'd almost start practicing self-compassion for self-improvement, then you're tricking yourself. So it has to come from an honest place.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. You almost think that the tough love, or like you hear and see a lot of tough love as, and I guess you can compassionately give yourself tough love, but sometimes you see like the strict go out and do things, mindset, grind your way through it without some of the compassion there.
Yeah. So I also talk about fierce and tender self-compassion. So tender self-compassion is about self-acceptance, about comforting and soothing ourselves. And fierce self-compassion is about taking action, you know, protecting ourselves or reaching our goals, meeting our needs. So there's both energetic qualities are there. Again, you can think of parenting as maybe a good example of that. We love our children unconditionally, but sometimes we need to, you know, get them off the couch and help motivate them and encourage them and help them reach their goals if we're good parents. And so both energies are there. So tough love, if the tough love is harsh or cold or critical, I think it's not very helpful. But if the tough love is warm and encouraging, I got your back, how can I help you? You can do this. Then it is actually helpful. And so again, just think as your heart, you can be angry with your heart open. Right. When you protect your child, you know, you're doing it out of love. You can be angry out of love and protection. That it means you don't dehumanize anyone. But the anger is just for saying, because someone is being dehumanized, that's where it comes from. You aren't feeding the dehumanization. You're kind of protecting the humanity of whoever it is you're protecting through the anger. So much of it really is just, what's your mindset? Is your heart open or closed? Why are you doing what you're doing? And those types of questions, again, are more about process, which is we need to think about these things.
I agree. Yeah. And when it comes to that third pillar, the mindset piece, you said something about how if we get kind of stuck in our emotion or stuck in the situation, that's not helpful just as much as ignoring it. So exactly. Talk to me about that balance. Like, how does someone know when maybe they're sliding into helplessness and need some of that more like loving, tough love to come in, or when they are maybe trying to put their head in the sand? Like, what are some ways to be mindful of that?
Yeah. And so that's why we do need to look. That's why mindfulness is so important, because if we don't actually introspect and ask, what's really true for me right now? And also, we also have different parts of ourselves. So part of me maybe have one goal, and part of it, so it gets complicated. It's true, not all parts of ourselves are wanting the same thing. But if we aren't willing to turn inward and just ask, why am I really doing this? What am I really after? What's really coming up for me? It's very hard for us to give ourselves what we need to be healthy, because we just don't know. And so mindfulness, it does take some intentionality. It's about shifting out of, again, being lost and I am so angry, or I'm so sad, and kind of we can feel I'm so angry, I'm so sad with no awareness. You're just kind of lost in the emotion or the thought. But as soon as you say, what am I feeling? Oh, I'm feeling a lot of anger. I'm feeling a lot of sadness. Then the moment we say that, we have a little bit of space around it, a little bit of awareness of it. We're shifting from the, you might say, being lost in the contents of what we're experiencing to the awareness of what we're experiencing. So it's like we're kind of taking a little step back. That's the mindfulness. But it doesn't come completely naturally. It's not really difficult, but it doesn't come completely naturally because of the way the brain is designed. Again, don't beat yourself up for it. All brains are like this. So that's why some people practice meditation. It doesn't even have to be meditation. It's taking a moment of silence, just taking a 3-second pause to take a breath. All those techniques are ways of disentangling from when we get really blended and lost in the difficult thoughts and emotions, taking the step back, being aware of what is it that's happening right now. It gives us that little bit of space we need to maybe make another choice. Okay, I'm really frustrated. Maybe I need to talk with someone right now. Maybe it's wise to talk with someone right now, or to take a breath or take a little walk. You know, it's not easy because of the way our brains are designed. There's something called the default mode network, which is actually, it's a survival skill to be lost in our thoughts and emotions. So again, don't beat yourself up for it. But it means we don't always make the wisest decisions.
Yeah, that makes sense. And in response to getting clarity on your feelings, would you say it's kind of a balance sometimes between turning inward for what needs could be met versus externally, like in a relationship? Let's say you're trying to be mindful because you just had a disagreement with your partner, and then you're feeling a little bit of worry or fear come up, like, what does this mean? And so being mindful would be to acknowledge, hey, I'm experiencing some fear, I'm experiencing some frustration, and then pause and decide, does this need to be something I soothe, or do I need to have a conversation? Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Yeah, exactly. And so really, one of the things self-compassion gives you, especially in relationships, one of the beauties of it, is your need for love and support, emotional support, isn't totally reliant on your partner. You can meet a lot of your own needs. And actually, I've done a lot of relationship with couples. We find that people who are more self-compassionate are happier in relationships, and their partners say that they're more like giving, more supportive, less needy in the relationship, because you're meeting some of your needs for yourself. It doesn't mean we don't also want to have a healthy relationship and you want to choose partners where it's reciprocal and balanced and all that, but you aren't putting all your eggs in someone else's basket. You know, you're saying, okay, well, maybe my partner isn't available to meet my needs right now. Does that mean I'm just screwed, basically? Or can I be there for myself? Can I meet my own needs? Can I give myself some soothing and support in this moment? And that gives us more resources to then give back to our partner and give our partner some space. And also, you know, maybe if the partner's not the right match for us, we don't feel so dependent on our partner. So it also gives us more freedom maybe to say, okay, this isn't working out.
Reciprocal effort you're sharing is like, you want people to be able to be compassionate towards themselves and their partner. And if you don't feel like that's being met, your partner is unable to be compassionate to you and towards themselves, then you kind of check in like, all right, am I getting the needs met that I want here?
Yes, exactly. And it just, we can be a little more intentional about it. But here's the thing. Even if we put all our eggs in someone else's basket, so to speak, if our happiness is completely dependent on other people's reactions to us moment by moment, it's guaranteed to fail us, because other people and just life in general, you know, people have their own stuff going on. Life happens, stuff happens, things change. And if we're totally dependent on the external world for our happiness, then we are guaranteed to be disappointed a good chunk of the time, you know, and a lot of that's luck of the draw. But if our happiness and our sense of fulfillment comes from inward, right? Just because I feel fulfilled because my heart's open. Maybe it's like, you know, I'm with a compassionate mess. Maybe things are a mess right now, but I'm full of compassion and I feel connected to the larger whole and my heart's open and I feel the sense of warmth and care. So that can actually be a moment of happiness, even in the midst of suffering. So what it does is it gives you this internal resource of love and connection, which is much more stable over time. Sometimes when I get upset about things, I think, Kristen, you're looking for love in the wrong place again. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's like, am I looking to get all my needs met from outside? No, actually, maybe I can turn inward. Again, it's not to say that we don't care about other people or we don't want healthy relationships. Yes, of course we do. But do we want to be dependent on that for our happiness? I mean, I'm single right now, and I could meet the best relationship ever, and in a week they get by a bus, or, you know, in other words, we can't control life. And so it's silly to look for all our happiness and love from the outside, especially when we have this internal wellspring here at any moment in our own heart and our own mind. It may be hard for people to believe, but I think a lot, you know, some people have different words for it. You can call it your higher self, your spiritual self, your compassionate self. Most people have some experience of that aspect of themselves that sometimes it comes out with people's pets. That warm, loving part of themselves arises. Well, we can actually get so much of our fulfillment when we get in touch with that warm, loving aspect of ourselves. It's always available 24/7. Really powerful, actually, to be less needy on circumstances, including other people, to feel happy and fulfilled.
Yeah, it is. And I know you've given a couple mentions throughout of the parent-child dynamic, and it's almost like, how could you have that archetypal inner parent inside of you responding and soothing you? And no matter how messy, as you said, some circumstances are, or if you wake up and you're just having a really hard day, like if you can still meet yourself with that kindness and understanding, then that's a micro moment where you can feel relief or feel like, okay, I'm okay and everything will turn out okay. But if you are always then beating yourself up for it, which has been a pattern of mine, then you just go further and further away from that loving inner self.
Exactly. So it's kind of it's the shift of focus. In a way, it's just a simple mindset shift. And it is simple. It sounds complicated, but it's really not. You just shift from what's happening to how am I relating to what's happening? And you start to get your sense of fulfillment a little more from, again, is my heart open? Am I being kind? Am I being supportive? Am I embracing myself and my experience? Than trying to get all your needs met from what's happening, which we've got a little say in what's happening. We don't have a lot of control. So much of it is outside of our control. And the causes and conditions are so complex. Our health, the weather, other people, politics, you know, what we ate that day. It's incredibly complicated. We have very little control about what's happening moment to moment. You know, we have some influence, but and this is amazing. We all have this ability to shift into how is my heart and my mind relating to what's happening. And we can find happiness and fulfillment in any moment by just making that simple mindset shift.
I love that. When it comes to relating to what's happening, is there anything, any circumstances where self-compassion and being more compassionate in how we relate to what's happening is not appropriate? Like I've always thought self-compassion could always be the final step, like no matter how crazy things are, but I'm sure there might be times where it's like a little bit less appropriate. I don't know. Is that even possible?
Well, if you define self-compassion as a common definition is concern with the alleviation of suffering or being with our suffering in a way that's healthy and helpful, then in some ways that's a bit of an oxymoron because if it's not helpful, then it's not self-compassionate, right? So I think what is important is sometimes we may fool ourselves. For instance, maybe I think I'm being self-compassionate when I'm really just letting myself slide on something and a behavior perhaps that's not helpful. And so we can fool ourselves. The brain, like I say, we have a tricky brain. We may fool ourselves and think we're being self-compassionate when in fact, what we're doing is not the best option for us. So that's one thing that can happen. You know, obviously, like if a lion starts chasing you, you want 100% of your energy to be in how do I get out of here? And how so that's actually the most self-compassionate thing to do. You wouldn't want to stop and like put your hand on your heart and say, this is so scary, a lion's chasing me. That wouldn't be self-compassionate. So it's self-compassion doesn't provide a script for what to do in any situation. It really is a process of how do I relate to myself moment to moment? And this moment's always changing. The circumstances are always changing in a way that best meets my needs and it's going to be healthy for me in the long run. So I don't know if that's a cop-out answer or not, but I think it is good to be aware that we definitely can fool ourselves. And you may be being self-indulgent instead of being self-compassionate. Yeah, I deserve that, you know, seventh, I don't know, donut or whatever it is. Is that really the healthiest thing for you right now? If it's not, then you're probably fooling yourself under the guise of self-compassion. So we always have to, that's what the mindfulness is so important. We have to be willing to look and say, what's really happening right now?
Yeah. What needs am I meeting by doing this?
Yes, exactly.
Beautiful. Well, I'd love to spend a little bit of time, of course, on relationships. And, you know, you said a little bit more about how if someone is more self-compassionate, then they can show up in their relationship in a much more compassionate way. But do you also find it's the opposite effect? Like if you are with someone who's really compassionate, my fiance sees the best in me that sometimes I don't see. And then sometimes he gives me the nudge to be a little bit more compassionate. So is it a two-way street or?
Well, other people can definitely help you be more self-compassionate. And, and compassion from others is wonderful. And ideally in a relationship, you know, moment to moment, you're each giving yourself self-compassion, giving each other compassion, supporting the whole process of compassion. That's the ideal. But of course, we can't always, the ideal doesn't always happen. So what we find certainly in the research is, so this big, I did a study of 100 couples and I measured the self-compassion levels of each person in the relationship. And also, what do you think your partner's self-compassion levels are? It was interesting. They were very accurate. So our self-assessment seemed to be, you know, our partners basically agreed with us. We asked questions about, you know, how your partner is in the relationship. And so what we found is the more self-compassionate people, the more they were described by their partners being compassionate to them, being supportive. People were happier with self-compassionate partners. They felt like they were less controlling, for instance. Also, they were more willing to make compromise solutions. So often what happens is power imbalances in relationships. Someone maybe who doesn't have a lot of self-compassion doesn't feel their needs are worthy of being met, always gives, you know, subordinates their needs to those of others. Or people maybe who are all about, maybe they aren't really self-compassionate. Maybe they're just like selfish, which is different. Selfish is my needs are more important than yours. And so maybe I'm not going to compromise. That's not self-compassion either, because of this common humanity component. It's all about this interconnectedness. So people were more willing to compromise. Okay, my needs are important and your needs are important. How can we come up with a win-win solution where everyone's needs, at least as much as possible, are being met? So that's kind of what happens when self-compassion is brought into relationships. It helps create more equal power relationships because everyone's needs are acknowledged as being important. It facilitates communication. Oh, the other thing we found, which is so key, is it increases authenticity. So again, if all my eggs are in the basket of my boyfriend must like me, if my worth comes from my boyfriend approving of me, and I'm just going to go along with everything he says, and I'm going to do whatever he wants, and I'm going to dress the way he wants me to dress, and I'm going to spout his opinions, then I have no authenticity. Now, if I'm not authentic in my relationship, I can't actually be intimate. Because what we know about intimacy is intimacy arises when two people are being their true authentic selves in relation to each other. If one person is putting on a mask to please the other, you can't really have true intimacy. So because with self-compassion, our sense of self-worth is intrinsic. I'm not giving it away to like, I'm worthy because you say I am. I'm worthy because I'm a human being. My sense of self-worth is unconditional. That allows me to be my authentic self. Again, there's so much research on this. Even if you give people a little prompt to be more self-compassionate, they have a more authentic response. And so that creates more authenticity and intimacy in partnerships. That's part of the reason people have better relationships when they're self-compassionate, because they can be their true self.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And they're met with more acceptance, I'm sure, because there's just more compassion everywhere.
And by the way, sometimes, for instance, drawing boundaries, one of the things, this is the fear self-compassion can give you, is the ability to draw boundaries. If I'm not so needy for other people liking me, I can say more authentically, sorry, that's just not going to work for me, or I need some space, right? And I'd be lying if I said that other people always love that. Sometimes they do. Sometimes they really wish you were a people pleaser who did everything they said. Like some relationships may not like it so much if one partner starts speaking up authentically and asserting their needs. But from my point of view, that weeds out unhealthy relationships, toxic relationships. You know, if your partner can't really accept the real you, do you really want to be in that relationship? So usually if it's a healthy relationship, people react positively. But when they don't, I think that's also like, it's actually a good thing that you know that. Now, having said that, sometimes people are like in 20-year marriages and it may not be the most self-compassionate. Let's say if you were to really draw a boundary or be totally authentic, your marriage would fall apart and you've got kids. So in other words, self-compassion can't say what is the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. Maybe in fact, the most self-compassionate thing to do is just to work with it. It's, you know, the situation you're in, how can I make it work for me? So it's not about, but when you do that, at least you know, okay, I'm worthy of getting my needs met. I'm choosing not to because the consequences would be too great and that wouldn't be good for me. As opposed to, yeah, I'm just not worthy. See, it's again about authenticity. Why am I doing it? Am I doing it out of love or am I doing it out of feelings of unworthiness? And it makes a huge difference in terms of the consequences of your actions internally and emotionally.
Yeah, that word intentionality comes back into play. Like I at least know what's going on. I recognize it and I'm still making the intentional choice.
Yeah, yeah. But again, not out of a sense of inadequacy or insufficiency, but out of a sense of, well, I think this is actually the wisest thing for me right now. May not be ideal, but for now, this is the best thing for me to do. And that comes from a place of love. Not. It's really when we start internalizing these feelings that I'm unworthy, I'm not worthy of getting my needs met, I'm a bad person. That's when we start creating this harsh inner environment that causes a lot of suffering.
And I'm not sure if you've done research on this specific thing, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts if there's any research or in your experience, if we have a harsh inner world, inner critic, does that mean that we're more likely to be harsh towards other people? Like, let's say we are really hard on ourselves and then that spills over into with our romantic relationships or friendships or family. Is that something you found?
Yeah. So I haven't looked at that personally, but my awareness of the literature is it just kind of depends. Like there's a saying, you need to be self-compassionate before you can have compassion for others. That's actually not true because many people are genuinely kind and compassionate and caring to others and treat themselves like crap. So it's not like that compassion isn't authentic. It's just very imbalanced. Mm-hmm. So for some people, that may be that if you're very harshly self-critical, you may take it out on others. For other people, they just maybe really totally, they treat themselves, the way they treat themselves is completely disconnected to how they treat others. But what we do know, this is interesting, is parents and children, that first of all, if you're critical to your kids, they're going to be more self-critical. They're going to internalize that. But if you're self-critical in front of your kids, maybe you don't directly criticize them, but you model for them, oh, I'm such an idiot, or I'm so stupid, then they're going to learn that that's the best way to be. So through the process of modeling what you model for other people, they get the message, okay, this is a good way to be with myself. And the opposite is also true. There's research showing that if you model self-compassion, then other people start being more self-compassionate because they think, oh, yeah, that makes more sense. She was so understanding toward herself about the mistake she just made. And you talked about, you know, supportive and how she was going to try to learn from it. Maybe that's a good way to be with myself.
Definitely. Yeah. It's so important seeing, you know, models of these types of things, but we can always practice internally as best as we can if we don't have those people around us, or look for people such as yourself, like talking about this thing and learn, you know, the tools or the ways that you relate to yourself or that you share, because sometimes we don't have the direct person in our life that's able or capable to model the things that we're looking to create.
Yeah. And it's amazing when both couples sign up, buy into self-compassion, because then you can help each other. There's actually a great book written by a friend of mine, Michelle Becker, Self-Compassion for Couples. Mm-hmm. And so it's all about how couples can use self-compassion as a way to strengthen the relationship. So for instance, if you're my partner, I could say, you know, hey, why don't you have a little self-compassion? Or, you know, you can strengthen each other's self-compassion practice when you both kind of have the value of self-compassion. You know, if we're having a fight, I could say, well, why don't each of us take a moment to give ourselves some compassion for the pain each of us are feeling? Like sometimes it's actually better to start with self-compassion before you try to be compassionate to your partner. Because when you give yourself compassion, you can calm yourself, you can center yourself, you can soothe some of your hurt feelings, for instance. And then when you come together, you're coming from a better, more open-hearted place.
Absolutely.
It doesn't always have, you know, there's so many, compassion can take almost any direction, from self to other, from self to self, other to self. You know, compassion is good any way it comes in. But if we leave ourselves out of that equation and compassion just flows outward and not inward, what happens is we become drained and burned out. we actually start developing, they call it compassion fatigue. It's actually, you might just say it's just being drained by the lack of self-compassion. And that's including in relationships. If it's just a one-way street, if we don't meet our own needs, then we're going to be, we don't have the, eventually we will run out of resources to keep giving to our kids or our partners, because we'll just be, we'll be dry and depleted, you know?
Yeah. I loved that invitation of, if you notice yourself feeling burnt out or resentful because you are giving too much, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to stop all of your giving, but you just need to pour some of that energy back towards yourself too.
To include yourself, you know, you have to breathe in and breathe out or else you'll die, basically. You have to breathe in. We actually teach a practice where you breathe in for yourself and you breathe out for the person you're with. So kind of imagine this flow of compassion in and compassion out.
I love that. Yeah. Are there any other kind of on the spot type tools that you recommend for people to practice more self-compassion?
Yeah. So one, because compassion is based in our physiology, primary way that parents convey compassion to their infants before they learn how to speak is through touch. Mm-hmm. So the human body is designed, touch is one of the primary signals of care and safety. So something as simple as, you know, putting your both hands on your heart or on your face, holding yourself in some way, you're actually activating your parasympathetic nervous system. You're changing your physiology. Your body feels literally held and cared for and supported. That can be a very easy way to give yourself compassion. You can also take what I like to call a self-compassion break, which is you bring in the three components of self-compassion, starting with mindfulness. Notice, I'm suffering. You know, you're giving yourself that little bit of space. You aren't lost in it, but you aren't ignoring it. Okay, this is hard right now. You know, being mindful of the fact that you're experiencing difficulty. Common humanity. This is part of life. This is part of being human. It's not, I'm not alone in this. It's not just me. And then words of kindness. How can I kind of give myself what I need in the moment? Some support, maybe encouragement, maybe some acceptance, maybe occasionally a little kick in the butt is what I need in the moment to be well. But you know, what is it that I need out of kindness in this moment? So when you bring in, and it's, if you just go straight to the kindness and you forget the mindfulness and the sense of common humanity, sometimes it can lead to something like self-indulgence or self-pity. When we bring in the mindfulness or the and the common humanity, it means that it's compassion and not self-indulgence or self-pity, which is healthy. So you really need all, it's like, how do you bake a self-compassion cookie? One part mindfulness, part common humanity, one part kindness. And again, there's a lot of research showing that when we bring in these three elements intentionally, it can help stabilize us, be more authentic, make wiser choices.
Yeah. I'm imagining a ice cream sandwich type cookie. Okay, snack.
You can do that as well.
Three layers.
Three layers, yeah. Yeah.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much for sharing all this. I just have two final questions for you. The first is one I ask all my guests, because this is the You Love and You Learn podcast. I would enjoy hearing one thing that you have learned about love that you would want to share with listeners.
Yeah. So the wellspring of source of love is from within. It's in our own awareness. It's actually not even the contents of what's arising. It's in the quality, the warmth of our awareness itself, which is always here. It's always present. So like I say, sometimes I catch myself, Kristen, you're looking for love in the wrong place. You're looking at it outside yourself. Remember where it really is. When I do that shift, it really helps. I wish I had learned that lesson a long time ago, but
yeah. Well, hopefully it will help someone who's listening to this right now. So I appreciate that. And aside from your TED Talk, which I'm going to link in the show notes, is there anything else that you want to share? Books, resources, where can people stay connected with you?
Yeah. So if you just Google self-compassion, you'll find me, my website, selfcompassion.org. I have an online community where you can connect with other people. You can get some mentoring and self-compassion. You know, I give talks. There's video resources. And there's also a lot of, just if you don't join the community, I've got free guided meditations. That's really the hub of self-compassion information, is at self-compassion.org.
Yeah, that's highly recommend. Yeah, some of the guided meditations and just, yeah, like the way that you speak about it is so self-compassionate and compassionate really towards others too. So thank you so much for all of your work. It was great to have you on, and I'm sure a lot of people are going to be hopefully practicing a lot more self-compassion after this.
Great. Thanks. It was my pleasure.
Yeah, thanks so much. See you in the next episode, everybody.
Thank you so much for listening to the You Love and You Learn podcast. If you've been enjoying the podcast, it would mean the absolute world to me if you could rate and review the podcast, because the more ratings and reviews there are, the more people that can hear this message. And it's really important to me to get this message out to the world and to create a space where people can learn about love and relationships in a way that is not judgmental, in a way that helps them expand their perspective from the cultural narratives that we've heard and seen in the movies and in Hollywood and the media. And the more ratings and reviews that are there, the more people that can hear this message. So thank you again so much. It really means the world to me that you are listening, and see you in the next episode.